regretted planting that little domestic tableau in her imagination. "How's your foot?"
"Hurts."
She took a huge swig of her wine, and he saw she'd downed a glass already. She got up, wincing, so that the peas fell onto the floor, and poured herself another. Then, as if she'd just remembered something, she reached into the pocket of her robe before holding up a little clear plastic bag.
"Nicky's stash," she said. "I decided this qualified as an appropriate moment for appropriating his drugs."
She said it almost defiantly, waiting for him to contradict her. When he didn't, she pulled out Nicky's papers and dragged a tourist guide from the glass coffee table onto her lap, where she proceeded to roll a haphazard joint. She lit it and inhaled deeply. She tried to smother a cough, then inhaled again. Her towel turban had started to slide, and irritated, she tugged it off, so that it was just her wet hair around her shoulders. She inhaled again, closed her eyes, and held it out towards him.
"Is that what I could smell when I came in?"
She opened one eye.
"You think I'm a disgrace?"
"No. I think one of us should be in a state to drive, just in case Tansy wants picking up." Her eyes widened.
"It's fine," he said. "Really. You go ahead. I think you need
a new life? To pull myself together? A good seeing to?"
She laughed mirthlessly.
"Oh no, I forgot. I can't even do that right."
"Jess."
She raised a hand.
"Sorry. Okay, let's eat."
They ate at the little laminated table beside the kitchen area. The curries were serviceable, but Jess barely touched hers, preferring to drink. She pushed the chicken biryani to and fro on her plate until it was clear that she wasn't going to eat more than a few mouthfuls, and he offered to clear it away. As he put the plates on the side and prepared to wash up, she faced him.
"I've been a total idiot, haven't I?"
Ed leant back against the kitchen units, a plate in his hand.
"I don't see how. I've worked it all out in the bath. I've been blathering to the kids all these years about how if you look out for people and do the right thing, it will all be okay. Don't steal. Don't lie. Do the right thing. Somehow the universe will see you right. Well, it's all bullshit, isn't it? Nobody else thinks that way."
Her voice was slightly slurred, its edges frayed with pain.
"It's not... No. 2 years I've been flat broke. 2 years I've been protecting him, not adding to his stress, not bothering him about his own children. And all the while he's been living like that, in his executive home, with his highlights and his designer jeans and his new girlfriend."
She shook her head in wonder.
"I didn't suspect a thing. Not for 1 minute. And I worked it out while I was in the bath. That whole do-as-you-would-be-done-by thing. Well, it only works if everyone else does it. And nobody does anymore. The world is basically full of people who couldn't give a shit. They'll tread all over you if it means they get what they want. Even if it's their own kids they're treading on. Jess."
He walked around the kitchen units until he was inches from her. He couldn't think what to say. He wanted to put his arms around her, but something about her held him back. She poured herself another glass of wine and lifted it towards him.
"I don't care about that woman, you know. That's not it. Me and Marty were over a long time ago. But all that crap about not being able to help his own kids, refusing to even think about helping Tans with school fees."
She took a long gulp of her drink and blinked slowly.
"Did you see that girl's top? That designer top? You know how much they cost? £67. £67 for a child's sweatshirt. I saw the price tag when druggy Aileen brought one round."
She wiped angrily at her eyes.
"You know what he sent Nicky for his birthday in February? A £10 gift certificate. A £10 gift certificate for the computer game shop. You can't even buy a computer game for £10. Only second-hand. And the stupid thing is, we were all really pleased. We thought it meant that Marty was getting better. I told the kid that £10, when you're not working, is actually quite a lot of money.
She started to laugh, an awful, desolate sound. And all the time
he was in that executive home, with his immaculate new sofa and his matchy-matchy curtains and his bloody boy band haircut, and he didn't even have the balls to tell me.
He's a coward, he said.
Yep, but I'm the idiot. I've dragged the kids halfway around the country on some wild goose chase because I thought I could somehow better their chances. I've put us thousands of pounds into debt. I've lost my job at the pub. I've pretty much destroyed Tansy's self-confidence by putting her through something I should never have made her do. And for what? Because I refuse to see the truth.
The truth?
That people like us never get on. We never move upwards. We just rattle around at the bottom.
That's not how it is.
What do you know?
There was no anger in her voice, just confusion.
How could you possibly understand? You're being done for one of the most serious crimes in the city. Strictly speaking, you did do it. You told your girlfriend what shares to buy so that she would make herself a heap of money. But you'll get off.
His glass stopped somewhere near his mouth.
You will. You'll get a couple of weeks inside, maybe a suspended sentence even, and a big fine. You've got expensive lawyers who will keep you out of any real trouble. You've got people who will argue for you, fight for you. You have houses, cars, resources. You don't really need to worry. How could you possibly understand what it's like for us?
That's not fair, he said gently. She turned away and inhaled. She inhaled like someone who wanted to actually black out. She pulled on the joint again and again, closing her eyes and exhaling upwards, the sweet smoke drifting towards the ceiling. Ed sat down beside her and took it from between her fingers.
I think maybe that isn't such a good idea.
She snatched it back.
Don't tell me what's a good idea.
I don't think this is going to help.
I don't care what you...
I'm not the enemy here, Jess. She shot him a look, then turned and stared at the fire. He couldn't tell if she was waiting for him to get up and leave, or maybe shout back at her. Just for once, he thought, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to sit this out.
I'm sorry,
she said eventually, and her voice was stiff, like card. It's fine.
It's not fine, she sighed. I shouldn't take it out on you.
It's okay. It's been a crappy day. Look, I'm going to have a bath, and then I think we should just get some sleep.
I'll be up when I've finished this,
she inhaled again. Ed waited for a moment, then left her staring at the fire. It was a mark of how tired he was that he didn't think any further than the bath. He must have nodded off in the water. He had run it deep, pouring in whatever unguents and potions he could find on the side, without looking to see what they were, and sinking in gratefully, letting the hot water ease out some of the tensions of the day. He tried not to think. Not about Jess downstairs, staring bleakly into the flames. Not about his mother, a couple of hours away, awaiting a son who wouldn't come. He just needed a few minutes of not having to think about anything. He lowered his head as far as he could into the water while still breathing. He dozed. But some strange tension seemed to have crept into Ed's bones. He couldn't quite relax, even as he closed his eyes. And then he became aware of the sound. A distant revving noise, uneven and dissonant. A whining chainsaw, or a driver learning how to accelerate. He opened an eye, wishing it would just go away. He had thought that this place, of all places, might offer the tiniest bit of peace. Just one night with no noise or drama. Was it really so much to ask?
Jess, he called when it became too irritating. He wondered if there was a music system downstairs, something she could turn on to drown it out. And then he realized the cause of his vague discomfort. It was his own car he could hear. He sat there, bolt upright for a split second, then leapt from the bath, wrapping a towel around his waist. He ran down the stairs two at a time, past the empty sofa, past Norman, who lifted his head quizzically from his spot in front of the fire, and wrestled with the front door until he had it open. A blast of cold air hit him. He was just in time to see his car bunny-hopping its way forward from its place in front of the cabin and along the curved gravel drive. He leapt off the steps, and as he ran, he could just make out Jess at the wheel, craning forward to see through the windscreen. She didn't have any headlights on. Jesus Christ! Jess! He sprinted across the grass, still dripping, one hand clutching at the towel around his waist, trying to cross the lawn to block her before she could get round the drive to the road. Her face swiveled briefly towards him, her eyes widening as she saw him. There was an audible crunch as she wrestled with the gears. Jess! He was at the car. He threw himself at the bonnet, thumping it, then at the side, wrenching at the driver's door. It opened before she could fumble for the lock, sending him swinging sideways.
What the hell are you doing?
But she didn't stop. He was running now, unnaturally long steps, braced against the swinging door, one hand on the wheel, the gravel sharp under his feet. The towel had long since disappeared.
Get off!
Stop the car! Jess, stop the car!
Get off, Ed! You'll get hurt!
She batted at his hand, and the car swerved dangerously to the left.
What the...
With a leap, he managed to wrestle the keys from the ignition. The car juddered and stalled abruptly. His right shoulder collided hard with the door. Jess's nose hit the steering wheel with a crack.
Fuck!
Ed landed heavily on his side, his head hitting something hard.
Fuck it!
He lay on the ground, winded, his head spinning. It took a second for his thoughts to clear, and then he scrambled unsteadily to his feet, hauling himself up by the still open door. He could see, through blurred vision, that they were feet from the lake, its shoreline an inky black near his wheels. Jess's arms rested against the airbag, her face buried in the gap between them, a faint wisp of smoke curling upwards from its seams. He reached across her and pulled on the handbrake, before she could somehow set the thing in motion again.
What the hell were you doing? What were you doing?
Adrenaline and pain coursed through him. The woman was a nightmare. She was chaos.
What the hell had she been thinking? What the hell had he been thinking agreeing to any part of this? Jesus, my head... Oh, no. Where's my towel? Where's the damn towel?
Lights were flicking on in the other cabins. He glanced up, and there were silhouettes in windows that he hadn't known were there, figures looking out at him. He cupped himself as best he could with one hand, and half walked, half ran for the towel, which was lying muddied halfway along the path, a glowing, crumpled pennant. As he walked, he lifted his other hand towards them as if to say, "Nothing to see here." Given the cold night air, this had swiftly become true, and a couple of them shut their curtains hurriedly. She was sitting where he had left her.
"Do you know how much you've drunk tonight?" he yelled through the open door. "How much dope you've smoked? You could have killed yourself. You could have killed us both."
He wanted to shake her, to show her the madness of what she had just done.
"Are you really so determined to dig yourself deeper and deeper into more crap? What the hell is wrong with you?"
And then he heard it. She had her head in her hands and she was crying into them a soft, desolate sound.
"I'm sorry."
Ed deflated a little, hitched the towel around his waist.
"What the hell were you doing, Jess? You must know this is crazy behavior." "I wanted to get them. I couldn't leave them there. With him."
He took a breath, made a fist, and released it.
"But we've discussed this. They're absolutely fine. Nicky said he'd call if there were any problems.
And we're going to meet them first thing tomorrow. You know that. So what the hell...
I'm scared, Ed.
Scared? Of what?
Her nose was bleeding, a dark scarlet trickle winding its way down to her lip, her eyes smudged black with mascara.
I'm scared that they'll like it at Marty's.
Her face crumpled.
I'm scared they won't want to come back.
And Jess Thomas came to rest gently against him, her face buried in his bare chest. And finally, Ed put his arms around her and held her close and let her cry. He had heard religious people talk about having revelatory experiences, like there was one moment where everything became clear to them and all the crap and ephemera just floated away. It had always seemed pretty unlikely to him. But then Ed Nichols had one such moment, in a log cabin, beside a stretch of water that might have been a lake, or might well have been a canal for all he could tell, somewhere near Carlisle. You see, he had once known a woman who had told herself she could do anything, and then decided she could do nothing. A woman who, finding herself at her lowest, did her best to push everyone away. And he realized in that moment that he had to make things right. He felt her injustices more fiercely than he had ever felt anything for himself. He realized, as he held her to him and kissed the top of her head and felt her cling to him, that he would do anything he could to make her happy and her kids, and to keep them safe and give them a fair chance. He didn't ask himself how he could know this after 4 days. It just seemed clearer to him than anything he had worked out in entire decades before. And so he told her. He told her, in the quiet tones of someone offloading a confession, that it would be okay. That he would make it okay. Because she was the most amazing woman he had ever met. And it was as simple for him as knowing that he couldn't not make it okay. And when she lifted her swollen eyes to his, frowning as she tried to make sense of what she was hearing, Ed Nichols mopped her bleeding nose, and he dropped his lips gently onto hers, and he did what he had wanted to do for the past 48 hours, even if he had been initially too dumb to know it. He kissed her, and when she kissed him back, tentatively at first, and then with a fierce, gratifying passion, her hand stealing up to his neck, her eyes closing. He picked her up, he was starting with the broken toe, carried her back to the house, and in the only way he could offer that he was sure wouldn't be misunderstood, he tried to show her. Because in that one moment, Ed Nichols saw that he had been more like Marty than he was like Jess. He had been that coward who spent his life running from things rather than facing up to them, and that something had to change. "Jess," he said softly into her skin some time later as he lay awake, marvelling at the 180-degree swings of life in general. "Will you do something for me?"
"Again?"
she said sleepily. Her hand rested lightly on his chest.
"Good God."
"No. Tomorrow." He leant his head into hers. She shifted so that her leg slid across his. He felt her lips on his skin.
"Sure. What do you want?"
He gazed up at the ceiling. "Will you come with me to my dad's?"
Chapter 24. Nicky. So Jess's favourite saying next to "It's all going to be fine" and "We'll work something out" and "Oh Christ, Norman," is that families come in all different shapes and sizes. "It's not all 2.3 now," she says, like if she says it enough times, we'll all have to actually believe it. Well, if our family was a weird shape before, it's pretty much insane now. I don't really have a full-time mum. Not like you probably have a mum. But it looks like I've required another part-time version. Lindsay. Lindsay Fogarty. I'm not sure what she makes of me. I can see her watching me out of the corner of her eye, trying to work out if I'm going to do something dark and gothic, or chew up a terrapin or something. Dad says she does something high up in the local council. He said it like he was really proud, like he's gone up in the world. I'm not sure he ever looked at Jess the way he looks at her. For about the first hour after we got here, I just felt really awkward. Like I'd basically just acquired one more place to feel like I didn't fit. The house is really tidy, and they don't have any books, unlike ours, where Jess has stuffed them into pretty much every room except the bathroom. And there's usually one by the loo anyway. And I kept staring at Dad, because I couldn't believe he'd been living here like a totally normal person while lying to us all the time. It made me hate her, like I hate him. But then Tansy said something at supper, and Lindsay burst out laughing, and it was this really goofy, honking laugh. "Foghorn Fogarty," I thought. And she clamped her hand over her mouth, and she and Dad exchanged a look like it was a sound she should have tried really, really hard not to make. And something about the way her eyes wrinkled up made me think, maybe she was okay. I mean, her family has just taken on a weird shape too. She had two kids, Susan, Josh, and Dad. And suddenly there's me, goth boy, as Dad calls me, like that's funny. And Tans, who was taken to wearing two pairs of glasses on top of each other, because she says the one pair isn't quite right. And Jess going nutso on her drive, and kicking holes in her car. And Mr. Nichols, who definitely has a thing about Mum, hanging around and calmly trying to sort everyone out like the only grown-up in the place. And no doubt Dad has had to tell her about my biological mum, who might also end up on her drive shouting one day. Like that first Christmas, after I moved in with Jess, where she threw bottles at our windows and screamed herself hoarse until the neighbours called the police. So, all things considered, Foghorn Fogarty might legitimately be feeling like her family isn't quite the shape she expected either. I don't really know why I'm telling you this. It's just that it's 3:30 a.m. and everyone else in this house is asleep. And I'm in Josh's room, with Tansy, and he has his own computer. Both of them have their own computers. Max, no less. And I can't remember his codes to do any gaming. But I've been thinking about what Mr. Nichols said about blogging, and how somehow if you write it and put it out there, like that baseball audience in Field of Dreams, your people might just come. You probably aren't my people. You're probably people who have made a typo while doing a search on discount tires or porn or something. But I'm putting it out here anyway. Just in case you happen to be anything like me. Because this last 24 hours has made me see something. I might not fit in the way that you fit in with your family. Neatly, a little row of round pegs in perfectly round holes. In our family, we've had to whittle at our pegs and our holes, because they all belong somewhere else first. And they're all sort of jammed in and a bit lopsided. But here's the thing. I realised something when Dad sat down and told me it was good to see me, and his eyes got all moist. My dad might be an arse, but he's my arse. And he's the only arse I've got. And feeling the weight of Jess's hand as she sat by my hospital bed, or hearing her try not to cry down the phone at the thought of leaving me here, and watching my little sister, who was trying to be really, really brave about the whole school thing, even though I can tell her world has basically ended. It all made me see that I do sort of belong somewhere. I think I sort of belong to them.
Chapter 25. Jess. Ed lay propped against the pillows, watching her do her makeup, painting out the bruises on her face with a little tube of concealer. She had just about covered the blue bruise on her temple where her head had bounced off the airbag, but her nose was purple. The skin stretched tight over a bump that hadn't been there before, and her upper lip bore the swollen, oversized look of a woman who had ill-advisedly indulged in backstreet fillers. "You look like someone punched you in the nose." Jess rubbed her finger gently over her mouth. "So do you."
"It did. My own car, thanks to you."
She tilted her head, gazing at his reflection behind her. He had this slow, lopsided grin, and his chin was a giant, bristly shadow. She couldn't not smile back. "Jess, I'm not sure there's really any point trying to cover it. You're going to look bashed up whatever you do." "I thought I'd tell your parents sorrowfully that I walked into a door. Maybe with a bit of a furtive sideways look at you." He let out a sigh and stretched, closing his eyes. "If that's the worst they think of me by the end of today, I suspect I'll be doing quite well." She gave up on her face and shut her makeup bag. He was right. Short of spending the day pressed against an ice pack, there was little she could do to make it look less battered. She ran a speculative tongue over her sore upper lip. "I can't believe I didn't feel this when we were... well, last night." Last night. She turned and crawled up the bed until she was lying full length along him. She knew this man. She knew every inch of him. She couldn't believe that they had not even properly met each other a week previously. He opened his eyes, sleepily, reached out and toyed lazily with a lock of her hair. "That'll be the sheer power of my animal magnetism.
Or the two joints and bottle and a half of Merlot."
He hooked his arm around her neck and pulled her into him. She closed her eyes briefly, breathing in the scent of his skin. He smelt pleasingly of sex. "Be nice," he growled softly. "I'm a bit broken today." "I'll run you a bath." She traced the mark on his head where it had hit the car door. They kissed, long and slow and sweet, and it raised a possibility. "Are you okay?" "Never felt better." He opened one eye. "No, about lunch." He looked briefly serious and let his head fall back on the pillow. She regretted mentioning it. "No, but I guess I'll feel better when it's done." She sat in the loo, agonizing in private, then rang Marty at 9:15 and told him that she had something to sort out and that she would now pick the children up between 3 and 4. She didn't ask. From now on, she had decided, she was just going to tell him how it was going to be. He put Tansy on the phone, and she said nothing about the evening, but demanded to know how Norman had coped without her. The dog was stretched out in front of the fire, like a three-dimensional rug. She wasn't entirely sure he'd moved in 12 hours, apart from to eat breakfast. "He survived. Just. Dad says he's going to make bacon sandwiches, and then we might go to the park. Just him and me and Nicky. Lindsay's taking Suze to ballet. She has ballet lessons twice a week." "That sounds great," Jess said. She wondered whether being able to sound cheerful about things that made her want to kick something was her superpower. "I'll be back sometime after 3, she said to Marty when he came back on the phone. "Please make sure Tansy wears her coat." "Jess," he said, as she was about to ring off.
"What?"
"Well, they're great. The pair of them. I'll just..." Jess swallowed. "After 3. I'll ring if I'm going to be any later." She walked the dog, left him stretched out in the front room, and when she returned, Ed was up and breakfasted. They drove the hour to his parents' house in silence. He had shaved and changed his T-shirt twice, even though they were both exactly the same. She sat beside him and said nothing, and felt, with the morning and the miles, the intimacy of the previous evening slowly seep away. Several times she opened her mouth to speak and then found she didn't know what to say. She felt as if someone had peeled a layer of skin off her, leaving all her nerve endings exposed. Her laugh was too loud, her movements unnatural and self-conscious. She felt as if she had been asleep for 1,000,000 years and someone had just blasted her awake. What she really wanted to do was touch him, to wind her hand into his, to rest a hand on his thigh. And yet she wasn't sure whether, now they were out of the bedroom and in the unforgiving light of day, that was appropriate anymore. She wasn't sure what he thought had just happened, and she was afraid to ask. Jess lifted her bruised foot and placed the bag of frozen peas back on it, taking it off and putting it back on again. You okay? Fine. She had mostly done it for something to do. She smiled fleetingly at him, and he smiled back. She thought about leaning across and kissing him. She thought about running her finger lightly along the back of his neck so that he would look over at her like he had the previous night, about undoing his seatbelt and edging across the front seat and forcing him to pull over just so she could take his mind off things for another 20 minutes. And then she remembered Natalie, who, 3 years previously, in an effort to be impulsive, had given Dean a surprise blowjob while he was driving the truck. He had yelled, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" and ploughed straight into the back of a mini metro, and before he'd had a chance to do himself up, Natalie's Aunt Doreen had come running out of the supermarket to see what had happened. She had never looked at Natalie in quite the same way again. So maybe not. As they drove, she kept stealing looks at him. She found she couldn't see his hands without picturing them on her skin, that soft mop of hair travelling slowly down her bare stomach. She thought about the smell of him, the tough muscle and the smooth skin of him. Oh, God. She crossed her legs and stared out of the window. But Ed's mind was elsewhere. He had grown quieter, the muscle in his jaw tightening, his hands a fraction too fixed on the wheel. She turned to the front, adjusted the frozen peas, and thought about trains and lampposts and maths Olympiads. They drove on in silence, their thoughts humming like twin wheels. Ed's parents lived in a grey stone Victorian house at the end of a terrace, the kind of street where neighbours try to outdo each other with the neatness of their window boxes. Ed pulled up, let the engine tick down. He didn't move. Almost without thinking, she reached out and touched his hand, and he turned to her as if he'd forgotten she was there. "You sure you don't mind coming in with me?" "Of course not," she stuttered. "I'm really grateful. I know you wanted to get the kids." She rested her hand on his briefly. "It's fine. Let's get it over with." They walked up the path, and Ed paused, as if checking what he was wearing, then knocked sharply on the front door. They glanced at each other, smiled awkwardly, and waited. Waited some more. After about 30 seconds, he knocked again, louder this time, and then he crouched to peer through the letterbox. He straightened up and reached for his phone. "Odd. I'm sure Jem said the lunch was today. Let me check." He flicked through some messages, nodded, confirming it, then knocked again. "I'm pretty sure if anyone was there, they would have heard," Jess said. The thought occurred, in passing, that it would be quite nice, just for once, to walk up to a house and have a clue what was happening on the other side of the door. They startled at the stuttering sound of a sash window being raised above their heads. Ed took a step back and peered up at next door.
"Is that you, Ed?"
"Hi, Mrs. Harris. I'm after my parents. Any idea where they are?" The woman grimaced.
"Oh, Ed, dear, they've gone to the hospital. I'm afraid your father took ill again early this morning."
Ed put his hand up to his eyes.
"Which hospital?"
She hesitated.
"The Royal, dear. It's about 4 miles away if you head for the dual motorway. You want to go left at the end of the road. It's okay, Mrs. Harris. I know where it is. Thank you." "Give him our best," she called, and Jess heard the window being pulled down.
Ed was already opening the car door. They reached the hospital in a matter of minutes. Jess didn't speak. She had no idea what to say. At one point she ventured, "Well, at least they'll be glad to see you." But it was a stupid thing to say, and he was so deep in thought that he didn't seem to hear. He gave his father's name at the information desk, and they traced him to Victoria Ward. "You know where oncology is, yeah?" the receptionist added helpfully, looking up from a screen. Ed flinched visibly at the word. They entered a steel lift and travelled up 2 floors. The doors opened, and the sign for the ward was in front of them. Ed gave his name on the intercom, cleaned his hands with the antibacterial lotion by the door, and, when the doors finally clicked open, she followed him through. A woman walked down the hospital corridor towards them. She was wearing a felt skirt and coloured tights. Her hair was cut in the short, feathery style that women use when they insist they're too busy to worry about their hair. "Hey, Jem," he said, slowing as she drew near. She looked at him, disbelieving. Her jaw dropped, and for a moment Jess thought she was going to say something.
"It's good to s-" he began. From nowhere, the woman's hand shot out and she smacked him hard. The sound actually echoed down the corridor. Ed staggered backwards, clutching his cheek. "What the... You fucking wanker," she said. "You fucking, fucking wanker." The two of them stared at each other, Ed lowering his hand as if to check for blood. Her jaw was clenched, as if she were waiting for him to say something, to do something, but he did nothing. She shook her hand then, staring at it as if she had surprised herself. And then, after a moment, she held it gingerly towards Jess.
"Hello, I'm Gemma," she said. Jess hesitated, then shook it carefully.
Jess. She frowned.
"The one with a child in need of urgent help." When Jess nodded, she looked her up and down slowly. Her smile was weary rather than unfriendly. "Yes, I rather thought you might be." "Right. Mum's down the end, Ed. You better come and say hello."
"Is he here? Is it Ed?"
The woman's hair was gunmetal grey, pinned up in a neat twist.
"Oh, Ed, it is you. Oh, darling, how lovely. But what have you done to yourself?"
He hugged her, then pulled back, ducking his face when she tried to touch his nose and giving Jess the swiftest sideways look.
I walked into a door." She pulled him close again, patting his back. "Oh, it is so good to see you."
He let her hold him for a few minutes, then gently disentangled himself.
"Mum, this is Jess. I'm Ed's friend." "Well, how lovely to meet you. I'm Anne."
Her gaze travelled briefly over Jess's face, taking in her bruised nose, the faint swelling on her lip. She hesitated just a moment, then perhaps decided not to ask.
"I'm afraid I can't say Ed's told me an awful lot about you, but he never does tell me an awful lot about anything, so I'm very much looking forward to hearing it from you."
She put her hand on Ed's arm, and her smile wavered a little.
"We did have a rather nice lunch planned, but..."
Gemma took a step closer to her mother and began rummaging around in her handbag.
"But Dad was taken ill again. He was so looking forward to this lunch. We had to put Simon and Deirdre off. They were just setting out from the Peak District."
"I'm sorry," Jess said.
"Yes, well, nothing to be done."
She seemed to pull herself together.
"You know, it really is the most revolting disease. I have to work quite hard not to take it all personally."
She leant into Jess with a rueful smile.
"Sometimes I go into our bedroom and I call it the most dreadful names. Bob would be horrified."
Jess smiled at her.
"I'll give it a few from me if you like." "Oh, please do. That would be wonderful. The filthier the better. And loud. It has to be loud."
"Jess can do loud," Ed said, dabbing at his lip. There was a short silence.
"I bought a whole salmon,"
Anne said, to nobody in particular. Jess could feel Gemma studying her. Unconsciously, she pulled at her T-shirt, not wanting her tattoo to show above her jeans. The very words, "social worker," always made her feel scrutinised, as if the woman had already worked out where Jess came from and was assessing her. And then Anne had moved past and was holding out her arms. The hungry way she pulled Ed to her again made Jess wince a little.
"Oh, darling! Darling boy, I know I'm being a terrible clingy mum, but do indulge me. Oh, it really is so lovely to see you."
He hugged her back, his eyes raising to Jess's briefly, guiltily. "My mother last hugged me in 1997, murmured Gemma. Jess wasn't sure she was aware that she had said it out loud.
"I'm not sure mine ever did," Jess said.
Gemma looked at her as if she'd forgotten she was there.
About the whole whacking my brother thing, he's probably told you what I do for a living. I just feel obliged to stress that I don't usually hit people. I don't think brothers count."
There was a sudden flicker of warmth behind Gemma's eyes.
"That's a very sensible rule."
"No problem," Jess said. Anyway, I've wanted to do it quite often myself over the past few days. Bob Nichols lay in a hospital bed, a blanket up to his chin, and his hands resting gently on its surface. It was clear from the pallor of his skin and the way the bones of his skull were almost visible that he was not a well man. His breathing was laboured, and his head swiveled slowly towards the door as they entered. An oxygen mask sat on a bedside table, and two faint indents on his cheek told of its recent use. He was painful to look at. "Hey, Dad." Jess watched Ed struggle to hide his shock. He stooped towards him and hesitated before touching his father lightly on the shoulder. "Edward?" His voice was a croak, but there was still something weighty within it.
"Doesn't he look well, Bob?" said his mother.
His father studied him from under shadowed lids. When he spoke, it was slowly and with deliberation, as if he had an allotted number of words to use. "No, he looks like someone beat the living daylights out of him." Jess could see the new colour on Ed's cheekbone where his sister had hit him. She found herself reaching unconsciously towards her injured lip. "Where's he been, anyway?" "Dad? This is Jess." His father's eyes slid towards her. His eyebrow lifted a quarter of an inch. "And what the hell happened to your face?" he whispered to her.
"I had an argument with a car. My fault."
"Is that what happened to him?" She didn't blink.
"Yes."
He regarded her for a moment longer.
"You look like trouble," he said. "Are you trouble?"
Gemma limped forwards.
"Dad, Jess is Ed's friend."
He dismissed her.
"If there's one small advantage to having very little time left, then surely it's that I can say whatever I like. She doesn't look offended."
"Are you offended?"
"I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. I don't seem to have any brain cells anymore."
"Jess."
"No, I'm not offended." He kept staring.
"And, yes, I probably am trouble," she said, holding his gaze.
His smile was slow to arrive, but when it came, she could see fleetingly how he must have looked before he got ill.
"Glad to hear it. I always liked girls who were trouble, and this one has been head down in front of a computer for far too long."
"How are you, Dad?"
His father blinked. "I'm dying."
"We're all dying, Dad," Gemma said.
"Don't give me your social worker sophistry. I'm dying uncomfortably rapidly. I have few faculties left and very little dignity. I will probably not make the end of the cricket season. Does that answer your question?"
"I'm sorry," Ed said quietly.
"I'm sorry I haven't been." "You've been busy."
"About that," Ed began. His hands were thrust deep in his pockets.
"Dad, I need to tell you something. I need to tell you all something."
Jess stood up hurriedly. "Why don't I go and get some sandwiches, leave you to talk?" Jess could feel Gemma assessing what she knew. "I'll get drinks too, tea, coffee?"
Bob Nichols's head turned towards her.
"You've only just got here. Stay."
Her eyes met Ed's. He gave a tiny shrug, like it was really not going to make any difference.
"What is it, dear?" His mother put a hand out to him. "Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. Well, I'm sort of fine. I mean, I'm healthy, but..."
He swallowed.
"No, I'm not fine. There's something I have to tell you."
"What?"
Gemma said.
"Okay." He took a deep breath.
"Well, here it is."
"What?"
said Gemma.
"Jesus, Ed, what?"
"I'm being investigated for insider trading. I've been suspended from my company. Next week I have to go to a police station where I will in all likelihood be charged and I may go to prison."
To say the room fell silent was an understatement. It was as if someone had come in and sucked out all the available air.
Jess thought she might pass out briefly from lack of oxygen.
"Is this a joke?" said his mother.
"No."
"I really could go and get some tea," Jess said.
Nobody paid her any attention. Ed's mother sat down slowly on a plastic chair.
"Insider trading," Gemma was the first to speak.
That's serious, Ed."
"Yeah, I do get that, Gem."
"Actual insider trading, like you see on the news."
"That's the one."
"He's got good lawyers," Jess said.
Nobody seemed to hear.
"Expensive ones."
His mother's hand had risen halfway to her mouth. She lowered it slowly.
"I don't understand. When did this happen?"
"A month or so ago. The insider trading bit, anyway."
"A month ago? Well, why didn't you tell us? We could have helped you."
"You couldn't, Mum. Nobody can help."
"But prison? Like a criminal?" Anne Nichols had gone quite pale.
"I think if you're sent to prison, you pretty much are a criminal, Mum."
"Well, they'll have to sort it out. They'll see that there's been some kind of a mistake, but they'll sort it out."
"No, Mum, I'm not sure it's going to work out like that." There was another long silence.
"Are you going to be all right?"
"I'll be fine, Mum. As Jess said, I have good lawyers, I have resources. They have already established that there was no financial gain for me."
"You didn't even make money out of it."
"It was a mistake."
"A mistake?" said Gemma. "I don't get it. How do you do insider trading by mistake?"
Ed straightened his shoulders and gazed steadily at her. He took a breath, and his gaze flickered towards Jess. And then he looked up at the ceiling.
"Well, I had sex with a woman. I thought I liked her, and then I realized she wasn't who I thought she was, and I sort of wanted her to go away without it all getting messy, and what she wanted to do was travel. So I made a snap decision and told her a way I thought she could make a little extra money to pay off her debts and go traveling."
"You gave her inside information?"
"Yep. On S-Fax, our big product launch." "Jesus Christ." Gemma shook her head. "I can't believe I'm hearing this."
"And my name hasn't come out in the press yet, but it will." He put his hands into his pockets and looked steadily at his family. Jess wondered if only she could detect that his hand was shaking.
"So, that's why I haven't been home. I was hoping I could keep it from you, maybe even sort it out so you didn't have to know anything about it, but it turns out that's going to be impossible. And I wanted to say, I'm sorry. I should have told you, and I should have spent more time here. But I didn't want you to know the truth. I didn't want you to see what a mess I'd made of everything." Nobody spoke. Jess's right leg had begun to jiggle involuntarily. She found a really interesting bit of skin beside her thumbnail and tried to make the jiggling stop. When she finally looked up, Ed was staring at his father.
"Well?" "Well, what?" "You're not going to say anything?"
Bob Nichols lifted his head slowly from his pillow.
"What do you want me to say?"
Ed and his dad gazed at each other.
"You want me to say you've been an idiot? I'll say you've been an idiot. You want me to say you've ballsed up a brilliant career? I'll say that too.
Bob."
"Well, what do you..."
Abruptly, he started to cough. A hollow, rasping sound. Anne and Gemma lurched forward to help him, handing over tissues, glasses of water, fussing and clucking like a pair of hens. It was as if everyone was grateful for being given something to do. Ed was standing at the foot of his father's bed.
"Prison," his mother said again.
"Actual prison, prison."
"That's what he said, Mum.
But this is awful."
"Sit down, Mum. Deep breaths." Gemma steered her mother into a chair. Nobody moved towards Ed.
Why didn't somebody hug him? Why could they not see how alone he felt right at that minute? I'm sorry, he said quietly. Nobody seemed to hear.
Can I say something? Jess could bear it no longer. She heard her voice clear and slightly too loud. I just want to tell you that Ed helped my two children when I couldn't. He drove us the length of the country because we were desperate. As far as I'm concerned, your son is wonderful.
They all looked up. Jess turned to his father.
He's kind, smart and clever, even if I don't agree with all the things he does. He's nice to people he barely knows. Insider trading or no, if my son turns out half the man your son is, then I'll be very happy. More than happy. I'll be ecstatic.
They were all staring at her.
She added, and I thought that even before I had sex with him.
Nobody spoke. Ed stared fixedly at his feet.
Well, Anne gave a faint nod. That's enlightening, said Gemma.
Anne's voice trailed away.
Oh, Edward.
Bob sighed and closed his eyes. Let's not get all Hollywood about this. He opened them again and signalled for the head of the bed to be raised a little. Come here, Ed, where I can see you. Wretched eyesight. He motioned for the glass again, and his wife held it to his lips. He swallowed painfully, then tapped the side of his bed so that Ed sat down on it. He reached out a hand and rested it lightly on his son's. He was unbearably frail.
You're my son, Ed. You might be idiotic and irresponsible, but it doesn't make the slightest difference to what I feel about you.
He frowned.
I'm pissed off that you could have thought it would.
I'm sorry, Dad. His father gave a slow shake of his head.
I'm afraid I can't be much help. Stupid, breathless.
He pulled a face, then swallowed painfully. His hand tightened around Ed's.
We all make mistakes. Go and take your punishment, then come back and start again.
Ed looked up at him. And Jess saw the boy he must have been. Hurt, desperate for his father's approval, and determined never to let that show.
Do even better next time. I know you can.
It was at that point that Anne started to cry. Abrupt, helpless tears that she buried in her sleeve. Bob turned his head slowly towards her.
Oh, darling, he said softly.
And that was where Jess acknowledged that she had finally become an intruder. She opened the door silently and slid out. She put some credit on her phone in the hospital shop, texted Ed to say where she was, and waited in A&E to get her foot looked at. Badly bruised, said a young Polish doctor, who didn't bat an eyelid when she told him how she had done it. He strapped it up, wrote a prescription for strong painkillers, handed her back her flip-flop and advised her to rest. Try not to kick any more cars, he said, without looking up from his clipboard. Jess hobbled back upstairs to Victoria Ward, sat on one of the plastic chairs in the corridor and waited. It was warm, and the people around her spoke in whispers. She may have nodded off briefly. She woke abruptly when Ed emerged from the room. She held out his jacket, and he took it without a word. A moment later, Gemma appeared in the corridor. They stood facing each other silently. His sister put her hand gently to the side of his face. You bloody idiot. His head dipped, hands shoved deep in his pockets like Nicky. You stupid, bloody, stupid idiot. Call me. He pulled back. His eyes were red-rimmed. I mean it. I'll come with you to court. I might know some people in probation who could help you get into an open prison. I mean, you're not going to be Category A, as long as you haven't done anything else. Her eyes flickered towards Jess and back to him. You haven't done anything else, right? He leant forward and hugged her. And maybe it was only Jess who noticed the way his eyes closed really tightly when he pulled away.
They emerged from the hospital into the luminous white of a spring day. Real life, inexplicably, seemed to have continued regardless. Cars reversed into two small spaces, buggies were disgorged from buses, a workman's radio blared as he painted a nearby railing. Jess found herself taking deep breaths, grateful to be away from the stale medical air of the ward, the almost tangible spectre of death that hung over Ed's father. Ed walked and looked straight ahead. They crossed the car park until they reached his car and he paused. The doors unlocked with an audible clunk. Then he stopped. It was as if he couldn't move. He just stood there, one arm slightly outstretched, staring blankly at his car. Jess waited for a minute, and then she walked slowly around it. She took the key fob from his hand, and finally, when his gaze slid towards her, she went to him and slid her arms tight around his waist. She held him until his head came slowly down to rest, a soft, dead weight upon her shoulder.
Chapter 26. Tansy. Nicky actually started a conversation at breakfast. They had been sitting eating around the table like a television family. Tansy had multigrain hoops, and Susie and Josh had chocolate croissants, which Susie said they had every day because it was their favourite. And it was a bit weird sitting there with Dad and his other family, but not actually as bad as she thought. Dad was eating a bowl of bran flakes because he said he had to stay in trim now and patted his stomach a lot, although she wasn't sure why, because it wasn't like he had an actual job. "Things in the pipeline, Tans," he said whenever she asked what he was actually doing, and she wondered if Lindsay had a garage full of air conditioning units that didn't work too. Lindsay didn't seem to eat anything. Nicky was toying with some toast. He never usually ate breakfast. Until this trip, he had never usually been up for breakfast. When he just looked at Dad and said, "Jess works all the time. All the time. And I don't think it's fair." Dad's spoon stopped halfway to his mouth, and Tansy wondered whether he was going to get really angry, like he used to if Nicky said anything he felt was disrespectful. Nobody said anything for a minute. Then Lindsay put her hand on Dad's and smiled. "He's right, love." And Dad went a bit pink and said, "Yes, well, things were going to change a bit from now on, and we all made mistakes," and because she felt a bit braver then, Tansy said, "No, strictly speaking, not all of us did make mistakes. She had made a mistake with her algorithms, and Norman had made a mistake because of the cows and breaking her glasses, and Mum had made a mistake with the Rolls-Royce and getting arrested, but Nicky was the one person in their family who hadn't made any mistakes." But halfway through her saying it, Nicky kicked her hard under the table and gave her that look. "What?" her eyes said to him. "Shut it," his said to her. "Urgh, don't tell me to shut it," hers said to him, and then he wouldn't look at her. "Would you like a chocolate croissant, love?" Lindsay said, and put one on her plate before Tansy had even answered. Lindsay had washed and dried Tansy's clothes overnight, and they smelt of orchid and vanilla fabric conditioner. Everything in that house smelt of something. It was as if nothing was allowed to just smell of itself. She had little plug-in things that released a luxurious scent of rare blossoms and rainforests dotted around her skirting, and bowls of potpourri that she sprayed from little bottles of scent, and she had about a billion candles in the bathroom. "I do love my scented candles." Tansy's nose itched the whole time they were indoors. After they'd got dressed, Lindsay took Suze to ballet. Dad and Tansy went to the park, even though she hadn't been to the park in about 2 years because she had sort of grown out of it. But she didn't want to hurt Dad's feelings, so she sat on the swing and let him push her a few times, and Nicky stood and watched, with his hands stuffed into his pockets. He had left his Nintendo in Mr. Nichols's car, and she knew he really, really wanted a cigarette, but she didn't think he felt brave enough to smoke one in front of Dad. There were chip shop chips for lunch. "Don't tell Linz," Dad said, patting his stomach. and Dad asked questions about Mr. Nichols, trying to sound all casual. "Who is he then, that bloke? Your mum's boyfriend?" "No," said Nicky, in a way that made it hard for